All right, and welcome back to WBCR 88.3 The Saint. I'm Justin Kenny, as always, and tonight we have a very special guest, Mr. Howard Scott Warshaw. So, Howard, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so before we get into the main meat and potatoes of what we're here to talk about, one question I have for you is, you're famous for also developing the ET video game, but how did you end up becoming a marriage and family counselor after that?
It was a long and winding road, I have to say. It was a lot of people think it's a very unusual transition to go from being a programmer to being a marriage and family therapist. And I get that. It's because most people don't think of programmers as being high people skills people, and therapists need to be. But I've never really seen it as that big a jump, because the way I've always looked at it is, programmers and therapists, we're all systems analysts, right? So it's just that I've moved on to a more sophisticated hardware in the human brain.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because like when I first saw it, I recently watched something like Atari and the in the ET video game. I was wondering, like, oh, I wonder what I can get from that time, because I know also Atari's not really around anymore. And I was able to find your information. I was sitting there wondering if I actually had the correct guy when I saw that it was a when I saw your information
A
for Atari.
therapist.
Yeah, I was kind of sitting there going, like, is this the right guy? Or am I emailing back and forth? I'm going to get him on, and he's going to start talking to me, like, what the hell are you talking about with the ET video game for? So.
Oh, you got the right guy, all right. And like I said, I recently published a book, Once Upon Atari, How I Made History by Killing an Industry. And yeah, because it's reputed that the ET video game destroyed the video game industry in the early 80s, which I discussed that quite a bit at length. But one thing you realize that Atari was an insanely wild and crazy environment. It was a super creative environment, but it was a wacky and wild environment. And I say being a therapist really helped to deal with an environment like that.
Yeah, now I mean I actually have the game right here
The ET game, nice.
in the box. I mean the box, the top's a little destroyed, but in the box, everything here. I mean, like, it's most of the time you find just the cartridge. I was able to get this on eBay for like 50 something bucks with everything. But so since you brought it up and how the game is kind of considered to be the one that almost killed the industry in 1983, do you think that's a little harsh, or do you think there were also other things that were just feeding into the industry crash of 1983?
Oh, I wouldn't call it harsh. I would call it entirely misdirected, entirely misunderstood. The idea that one single game destroyed the entire game industry is absurd. I'll give you an example of that. Like I talk about in the book, Once Upon Atari. How much did Atari lose on the ET project? Let's say at the worst case, let's say they lost like $40 or $50 million, which they didn't. No, they didn't lose that much on it. But let's say they lost $50 million on that project. This was a $4 billion industry. Atari had revenues around $1 billion around that year. So the idea that that destroyed the industry is a total fiction. I have a very eclectic and unusual background, of course, because I have degrees in economics, mathematics, computer engineering and counseling psychology. So I am uniquely qualified to really analyze and look at this whole thing, in addition to having been there. And so I had seen enough media and enough things about the whole what brought the crash on and things, people, how it was misattributed. And so I decided to write a book to really explain, for one thing, what the real causes of the crash were. And I go into that in great depth. Also, to explain what life at Atari was like, because Atari changed the world. Right? Atari was the place that turned television from a passive activity into an active activity, right? You know, people used to be zombies sitting on the couch staring at the TV. and video games turned them into zombies who were jumping up and down on the couch yelling at the TV. It's an entirely different experience.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, but also now also think about it too, you're also now kind of eternal in the industry, because now, I mean, this game is going to pretty much live forever now, whether it be infamous or famous. And
I'll never live it down.
Yeah, it's
so I might as well live it up.
Well, that's one way to put it. I mean, you are, it does seem that you're a glass is half full type of guy now, so that's good.
I am very much that, either that or a glass is too large.
Yeah.
See, that's it. To me, it's all about taking new perspectives and fresh perspectives and seeing things in different ways. That's what made me, I think, a good video game programmer. The idea that E.T. is considered to be the worst video game, so bad that it destroyed the industry, I don't really believe that's true for a second. But to tell you the truth, I prefer it when people do recognize it that way. Right, I like being the person who made the worst video game of all time, because I also made a game called Yara's Revenge, which is frequently cited as one of the best games of all time. So as long as E.T. is the worst, I have the greatest range of any game programmer in history, and I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it. I mean, like, even look at somebody like Shigeru Miyamoto at Nintendo. I mean, like, he's created Zelda, Mario, even like Ocarina of Time, which to me is one of the greatest games of all time. But then, like, even he's had a few flops and bad showings and everything too. And he's considered to be like the Walt Disney of the video game world.
Yeah. And deservedly so.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so one thing now that I'm a little interested in too is what was Atari like when you were there? Because you always hear these stories about, I guess kind of nowadays, it's the crypto market that's kind of like the Wild West of industry, where either that or the marijuana industry, where it's kind of like the Wild West. Businesses aren't really structured. The whole entire industry has gone corporate. If you're an investor, you're kind of told to be careful investing in that industry because you don't know who's going to last. Or it could be like just a couple guys around like one plant in their mom's basement or something like that. What was it like at Atari during that time?
Well, I mean, and that's what this book is about, what it was like there, how it was changing. It was a life-changing experience. Certainly changed me. And it was, you know, what I like to say is that, you know, when you expect things to make sense, you're losing touch with Atari. Because Atari was not about making sense. Atari was about making fun. It was an orgy of creativity and just populated by the most amazing and eccentric cast of characters you can possibly imagine. Engineering at Atari was just a bunch of really intelligent, but very eccentric and somewhat oddball characters, all in different directions and different dimensions. So going to work was an amazing experience, just because I'm going to start running into really interesting people, and they're all going to be off in some weird direction one way or another. And it was just incredibly stimulating. Most work experiences that I had dealt with before, and many of them since, were just boring. It just wasn't that challenging. It wasn't that interesting. It wasn't that engaging. Atari was a place where you never knew what you were going to step into. Some days it could be unbelievably exciting and rewarding and fun. Some days it could be terrifying. Because it was, like you said, I think the Wild West is a great analogy for it.
Yeah.
And if you talk about like the mixture of crypto and the marijuana industry, that's a lot like what Atari was, because it was trying to create this new medium in a technology that a lot of people didn't understand. And there was a lot of marijuana around. So it was very much like crypto meets the marijuana industry. It's an interesting thing to think about when your job description is to come in and do something that's cool that no one's ever seen before, right? So a good day at Atari results, after a good day's work, I've got something new that never existed when I got up, up that morning. That's a good day at Atari. And there were many days like that. It was just, it was incredibly invigorating and inspiring and terrifying at the same time. Because when you come up with something fascinating and new, that's really exhilarating. But when you're responsible for coming up with something fascinating and new and you don't have something fascinating and new, that's horrifying. That's a very scary place to be. You know, waves came. And there were times where you're feeling great and on top of the world, and there were times where you're not sure if we have a job tomorrow. Both of those happen semi-regularly.
Yeah, I mean, I know you also worked for other companies before that too. Like, I believe I read somewhere that you worked for Hewlett Packard as well, like right before you went to Atari.
Mm-hmm.
What was kind of like the main difference between Atari and HP? Was it just like structure, or was it like, I can see you laughing now.
Yeah, it's because everything was different. It was entirely different. HP was a staid corporate environment that was all about being on target, being on track, and a massive bullpens of people just working away, coding away on their terminals, doing fairly menial programming, not super challenging stuff. Atari was about breaking ground in new and unusual ways. You had an audience. At Atari, you're working for an audience. At HP, you're working just to achieve a certain level of functionality. The people, I mean, I used to think of Hewlett Packard as the software pastor because it was sort of the place where programmers go to die. It's the way I thought of it. Because when I was in college, I got involved with computers, and it was exciting to me because it was interesting, it was engaging, really fascinating work. And I was super passionate about it. When I got to Hewlett Packard, all the passion that I had for programming and computing disappeared because the work they were doing wasn't that. It wasn't the exciting kind of challenging programming I like to do. When I got to Atari, it reawakened all of that for me because Atari was doing the kind of really challenging, it's called real-time control programming. And back in the early 80s, there was basically two places you could do real-time control programming, or two industries. One was video games. The other was essentially missile guidance systems. That's also real-time control programming. I was qualified to do either. So I decided I would rather entertain people than try to kill them for 12 cents a head. It felt much more agreeable to me. And also, it was easier to get the security clearance at Atari than it was like working at the government military systems.
Yeah. One thing I kind of get the sense of with you is that, like, especially after your answer to my last question, was it kind of runs a lot with Viktor Frankl, like, especially Man's Search for Meaning. I don't know how familiar, well, you probably are familiar with that since you are a therapist yourself. But it's kind of just like the notion. I mean, I read it in English class, and I've read it at least three or four times after. It's one of my favorite books, where it goes, it's like, you find meaning in your life once you find meaning in what you do. For, I guess, and I guess it's for you, it's like finding meaning in entertaining people rather than, as you put it, killing them for in the military or the war industry.
Yeah, I definitely see an upside there. But, you know, Viktor Frankl is very big in existentialism.
Yeah.
And existentialism is really interesting because it's all about four things, basically. We're all alone. We're going to die. There's no point to life. And we're responsible for what we do.
Yeah.
And that's a lot for a lot of people to carry. But for some people, it just makes perfect sense. It's just sort of like the way life is. And what was amazing about Atari was that the kinds of things that you normally worry about or deal with in regular jobs, because Atari wasn't like a regular job. It was a very different kind of work experience. And I had worked in other classic corporations both before and since Atari. In a normal work environment, you have, you know, clear goals. They're very usual, especially for programming, they're usually very specifically and clearly defined. And you write your code so you meet your spec. And you go and you do your job, and it's a fairly 9-to-5 kind of experience. And You go and you hope that you get a bonus and you hope you do okay to make your review and all of that. And it's easy to tell where you're at in those kind of jobs. It's also easy to fall asleep in those kind of jobs. And at Atari, you could do all the programming and all the technical work exactly right. You could have everything exactly according to spec, the way it was supposed to be. And then you go and sit behind the two-way mirror during a focus test where you watch a bunch of 11, 12, or 13-year-old kids play your game while they're eating pizza. And if after a couple of minutes they just sort of toss the controller aside, go, ah, this sucks. That's it. And all the work that you have done is essentially wasted. And they're absolutely right, too. That's the thing, is those kids are right. So the idea that there's one thing you find in a spec when you're doing a video game that you never find in any other technical spec anywhere. And that is that in addition to all the technical requirements that have to be met, your product has to be fun.
Yeah.
And that is a very difficult thing to stipulate or analyze clearly. People have been trying to figure out what makes fun for, you know, millennia. Okay.
Yeah.
And no one's really come up with the formula for it. We have formulas for some jokes, but, you know, formulaic application of fun just doesn't work very well. It's the kind of thing where you know it when you see it. And so to be a productive game programmer, you have to have all the technological capacity of any other programmer, but you also have to be this weird, absurd kind of anal goofball, right? You have to have this anal retentive nature to get all these minuscule, ridiculously minute details absolutely correct. And you still have to be goofy enough to have a sense of fun, a sense of absurdity, and to be able to grab and come up with ideas out of nowhere and then turn them into computer code that works on a very limited hardware. It was the kind of challenge that I love that drives a lot of people nuts. In fact, it actually drove a lot of people at Atari insane, literally. I've never seen as many nervous breakdowns and people literally carted away as I did at Atari, because the pressure, you know, when a corporation is waiting for you to produce the product that they're supposedly have many millions of dollars riding on, that can be a lot of pressure for some people.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing that always fascinates me about trying to, because, like, I'll admit, I would never be great, like, writing a show or game or something like that, making it fun, unless I had like the specific formula, because that's just not my sense of thinking. But I've always been fascinated by people who are definitely of an older age, and they can make shows for like people my demographic, 18 to 34, or even younger, with kids and preschoolers, and how they're able to just take their mindset, put it aside, and then put a mindset for my generation, high schoolers, middle schoolers, preschoolers. Because another guy who's been on the show is Fred Seibert, the inventor of the credit inventor. He says he didn't do it, it's his boss, but he gets credit for it. He was one of the people who was credited with I Want My MTV. But another thing, when he was at Hanna-Barbera and also Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network, was they ran into this interesting problem where kids were showed these shows. And if they didn't like the show, it was for babies. But if they liked it, it was good. Even if they were a 7-year-old and they thought the show was made for 6-year-olds, it was still for babies. So it's just like, how do you get to that little, like, how do you not, like, kill the kid inside you to be able to get to them in the future? So,
oh, Johnson, that's a really excellent point. And actually comes back to making the transition from programmer to therapist.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, one of my personal beliefs is that, you know, adulthood is not the cessation of childhood. Adulthood is the incorporation of childhood into a more complete picture. You can't lose sight of your child, or I think you lose a major part of who you can be. But what you're talking about, the idea of being able to put your perspective, your current perspective aside and take on the perspective of a target audience. Another name for that is empathy, right? The ability to empathize with a certain audience and really see the world through their eyes without losing touch with your own. And that's something you have to do when you produce entertainment. It's also something you have to do as a therapist. And so you can see how, like, ordinary programming might be fairly dull for me, but this kind of programming really suited the part of me that was also really well suited to becoming a therapist.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to pretend that all programmers are super high people skills people, but it's really interesting if you think about the idea. And I go, there's a chapter in my Once Upon a Atari book called A Nerd World Country, where I go into explaining nerds and technology and things like that to people who are not fundamentally nerds. And one problem that a lot of people have with nerds is they can feel they're very hard to communicate with. That, quote, normal people hate talking to programmers and real high techies because they feel they can't communicate with them because those people just don't know how to talk to people.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to think about is the truth is that programmers are actually extremely skilled communicators. Okay. Because if you think of computers, like what, when you program a computer, what do you use? They call it a computer language, right? Computers have computer languages. And that a programming a computer is actually an exercise in communication because you have a language the computer understands. And the better, the more eloquent I can be in that language, the better a programmer I'm going to be. So programmers are actually people who have to be really good at understanding language and translating concepts through that language. And so they're really very skilled communicators. The problem with it is that when you communicate with computers a lot, computers are not people.
Yeah.
And the big difference between computers and people is that people add meaning and interpretation and create latitude in communication that computers don't. Computers are extremely rigid. Things are either right or wrong, or they match or they don't. And that's all computers do. So some programmers who are get too into programming and get too comfortable with the idea, it comes out of what I call the 80-20 model of programmers.
Yeah.
Right. There's like in the programming world, there's like about 80% of programmers, in my opinion, are people who get involved with computers because they're not like people, because computers don't play politics. They don't Zoom you. They don't do wacky stuff with you. They just tell you the truth and they give you honest, direct feedback. No fluff, no passive aggressive behavior. It's just straight up stuff. They're very honest and pure. And people are not. So some people really who have trouble dealing with people like dealing with computers because computers are not messy like people are.
Yeah.
That's the 80%ers. 20%ers are super expressive types, and the computer is just another mode of expression. So 80%ers, if they weren't programmers, they would be like accountants or actuaries or fact checkers. 20%ers, if they weren't programmers, would be like musicians or artists or sculptors.
Yeah.
More things like that. And at Atari, the thing is, I call it 80-20 because most places I've worked, about 80% of the programmers usually are like what I call the 80%ers. And you have 20% that are sort of the more creative types. At Atari, that's the only place I've ever worked in technology where it was almost 100% 20%ers, right? Where all the programmers were creative people. They all had some other skill. And so programmers are really skilled communicators, but in a very narrow range, and they want you to be super specific. And most people are really not even capable of being as specific as computers require you to be. And when a programmer starts to emulate that, it's really irritating to the people who are trying to talk with them. So they say, well, those people don't know how to communicate. That's not true. What they don't know how to do is commune with others in a social way that feels comfortable, but they're very skilled communicators. And it's kind of funny to think of it that way because, you know, if programmers are such great communicators, why is it such a pain in the ass to talk with them? Well, I answer that question in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my vision of who programmers are is kind of skewed because most of the people I know who are programmers kind of fall into the 20%, where it's like WVCR, our own Monty Jennings, who hosts the Afternoon Drive, or not the Afternoon Drive, who hosts the Afternoon Escape. He's a programmer himself, but he also credits having the radio backgrounds making him more social. Him and I had this whole entire conversation about this, but then also my best friend since first grade. He's now just graduated with a programming and cybersecurity degree, and he's going into the programming world. But he's probably the most social person I know. Knows people all over the place, dates a lot. He's even created his own version of Dungeons and Dragons and all these different other things. Like, he's really a crazy individual, but he's still a programmer. So, but a lot of our people I've seen, even though they aren't my friends, when they first interacted with them, like maybe because I go to a liberal arts institution, so a lot of people take me pure science that are also doing other things. But if I went over to RPI, it'd be a different story. But yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, but also you're also kind of making Atari sound like the Wolf of Wall Street was for finance in some ways. Because everybody,
It was very much like that. It
yeah.
was a wild, insane environment. Now, engineering at Atari was separate. I mean, there was a lot of Atari, like, the marketing and management and stuff that was a lot more formal and standard, especially once Warner took over. There was a big difference between the original Atari that Nolan Bushnell was running and the Atari that and Warner Communications bought Atari, and they instilled their own management. And there was a cultural shift that also was a significant contributor to the overall crash and some of the things that went on at Atari, because there was this incredible conflict between the creative culture in engineering that Nolan Bushnell had established and the corporate responsive culture that Ray Kazar and the Warner management were trying to implement. And what I like to say is that you want, when you're doing a creative endeavor, you want people who can think outside of the box.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the kind of people who really think outside of the box don't keep their arms and legs inside the car. When you try to put them back in the box, you got a real problem because they keep busting out. Because if you think about it, real innovators are people with boundary issues. And so that works great when you're trying to innovate. It does not work great when you're trying to expect people to adhere to corporate dictates and mandates to maintain some sort of formality. That's not a good fit at all.
Yeah, I mean that's where you get the statement of they went corporate, which
Right. They lost their culture and went corporate. They went bland. And it's frightening. What you're saying about programmers, though, makes a lot of sense, but I'm guessing you didn't meet most of the programmers you know in a programming class.
no.
You're an interesting guy. I mean, and you're a media-focused person. You're doing this show,
Yeah.
and that's cool. So I guess you're going to tend to meet other people who have interests that are, so you're going to happen to run into programmers who are doing what you primarily want to connect with them about.
True, that's
And
true.
so that's just the programmers who left class to go and do something else. There's that whole bunch of other ones that are over at RPI still sitting in class and in the lab, and you'll probably never run into them. So
Yeah.
you've had a wonderful experience, because I have to be honest with you, even for me, as a longtime seasoned programmer, 20%ers are much more interesting and fun to talk to
Yeah.
than 80%ers. That's just my personal opinion, but I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, I mean, like it's the same with me because, I worked for Goldman Sachs for a year or two, and before the layoffs, and then even there, I mean, it's just like people when they go when they see like the Wolf of Wall Street or like The Big Short or some of these other movies that come out, they're like, oh my God, I'm gonna be coolest guy in the world. I'm just like gonna be making all this money. All these girls who want to be with me, this and that. And then they get there and you're just sitting at a computer screen doing Excel files all damn day. And
Exactly.
you're just making, especially if you worked like at Goldman Sachs, like I did, you're just making already rich people richer. And so like for me, it's kind of like, yeah, it's not really what I want to do. I'd rather do something like I don't know, financial planning or something, help people actually be able to have a retirement or something like that. But it's still funny to me how people, like when I was at Boise State, we had to run for, you would run for like treasurer or president or governor or something like that. And this one kid got up on stage and was like, "You know the movie Wolf of Wall Street? That was based on my life as a joke trying to get votes, I guess." But it's I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with finance. Most financial people aren't that funny either.
It's true. And that's the thing. It's like, most people remember the marketing video, but that's not the actuality of the job.
Yeah,
And
I mean,
it's nobody wants to tell the story of a really boring job of somebody sitting at a screen doing stuff that isn't particularly interesting.
it's the same thing with video gamers. I mean, it's, I don't know if you would say it's 80-20 or 70-30, but then there's the faction video gamers that are very social and popular, and then you got the other ones who aren't really. And it's just, I see both through my friends. Like, I have some friends who aren't the most social, but are huge video gamers. And I have friends who are very social and are huge video gamers. And so it's one of those type of deals, I guess. But
Right. What you learn is like, the kinds of activities people engage in and their degree of sociability or ability to be sociable, those are independent vectors. They're just separate dimensions of personality, right? Because there isn't any rule that people who do a certain kind of thing must be either interesting or uninteresting to deal with or talk with. They're all different, but there are certain combinations that don't occur that frequently together. And it is true that a wildly fun, socially engaging individual and someone who does really intricate, detailed technical work, either programming or finance, like deep, deep finance, you don't see as many wild and crazy people in those environments, but they're there. It's just they're reduced to a lower percentage.
I mean, it's kind of like for me too. I mean, like, I recently watched this thing on Great Big Story, which I know you were also featured on at one point. There was another one about I think the boat was called the Comanche, where they're taking the boat and try to cross the Atlantic in the record time. One of the guys who was on that boat was Stan Honey, who's friends with Bushnell. I don't know if he was actually at Atari, but he did also for like sports, he did do the first down lines on NFL games and football games, and also did the glowing puck, which is not very popular with hockey. People thought it was too distracting. And with how fast the hockey puck goes, I mean, I kind of can get where they're coming from, but he's not just a
Works way
programmer.
better with football, yeah.
He's not only a programmer, but he's also considered to be like the arguably the best sailing navigator in the world. So, I mean, it's kind of just like sometimes you see people like even yourself being a therapist, or Nolan Bushnell also going out to start Chuck E. Cheese. They have multiple interests in multiple different ways. So, I mean, it's kind of, that's also another thing too. It's kind of interesting means for some.
Well, it's true, and it goes to the way you look at people or things. Like, if I were to say to you, is something interesting or uninteresting as an activity or as an object, right? The idea being that you're trying to say, well, is the interest inherent in the thing itself? And the answer, I think, is no, there's nothing inherent in objects. We have perception, and interest is something we derive. It's not something that's automatically in something. So people are like that in the regard of like when we see someone who's really good at something, we tend to think of them as unidimensional because we want to think that somebody who's really good at one thing, well, that must be what they do, and that's all they do. And it's true that there are people who can practice their way into mastery, and they put all their time and effort into doing that one thing, and that's what they do, and they do that really well. There are also people who are innately talented or innately gifted in some way or fashion. And those people walk around and bring that talent to a variety of different tasks or they can. And you'll see whatever they go and do, they may not be the absolute best, but they're going to distinguish themselves in some way in that task because that's who they are, because they're bringing a different perspective to what they're doing. And that enables them to do it differently and achieve distinction with it. And so you see them pop up. So that's how someone could be like a remarkable TV technician in terms of creating new opportunities for a television screen, and also be, you know, a top tier navigator, you know, for crossing the ocean. It's not that you have to work so hard to be both. It's that someone who acquires and practices skills with great facility can apply that ability in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, and then there's also the sportscaster, Colin Cowherd, who also said this one time, that it's kind of like his theory that successful people are usually curious. So, like, I've never met a successful person that isn't curious. That, like, they're always into trying new things. Like, I even think about myself, like, I've done hiking, I've done judo, I'm an Eagle Scout, so we have done literally everything, all that stuff. I've done this, I have both a political science degree and an MBA. So it's kind of like all over the place. But then go other people where it's kind of like they're interested in wine, but they're also a money manager and this and that. So it's like, because I think, like, as you put it, we kind of start thinking people's one-dimensional when people are really three-dimensional in most cases.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really good point, is that curiosity. I mean, in my therapy practice, this comes up a lot. I always pose it as the difference between curiosity and judgment, right? We can either judge things or we can be curious about things, right? Yeah. When we judge things, we bifurcate the world. We reduce the world to either things that are matching what I'm looking for or things that don't, and I tend to throw all those things out. When I'm curious, I'm taking in everything that's around me. And where that really comes into play is when you're trying to solve problems. Right. Because a person who solves problems, they usually approach it one of two ways. Either I'm looking for any solution to the problem, or I'm looking for a specific solution to the problem, because I go in with a preconcept of what I need to solve the problem. So the metaphor I use for this is the idea of, like, let's say I'm hungry and I'm hungry for a hot dog, and I go down the street and I pass a pizza place, and there's a Chinese restaurant, and there's a burger joint, and all this stuff. But I get to the end of the street, and it's like, God, I'm really hungry. And now there's nothing to eat here because I really wanted a hot dog.
Yeah.
If I go down that street and just say, I'm hungry, what's available? There's lots of options available that will work for me. And the thing is, when we solve problems, a lot of times we get so focused on how we need to solve the problem, which is judgment. I'm judging everything to say, does this meet my expectation or not? If it doesn't, I throw it out. Instead, if I stay curious, I may see lots of things that I wouldn't have thought of as solutions before. But now when I think, does this solve the problem? I'm open to more things, and I get more creative and innovative solutions. Yeah. It's just a better way to go, and it opens me up. So curiosity is huge, but also the desire to acquire and learn, not just to be curious, but to pursue the knowledge, to pursue the ability or the skill a little bit. I've been through like five careers. I mean, I'm a therapist now, but between programming and therapy, I was also I'm an award-winning documentary filmmaker. I've written four books. Once Upon a Tari is just my latest book. I've done commercial photography. I've done lectures. I did some teaching for a while. There's a lot of different things I like to do because I get bored. You know how it is when you've done the same thing for a while and you feel it doesn't really hold much, and I need more. I need to keep growing. So when I felt like I'm kind of done with this area, I go find a new area and I go in that direction. And the thing that's brilliant about therapy for me was it's not just something I really enjoy doing. It's some of the most gratifying work I've done since working at Atari. The thing about therapy is that it's one of the few jobs that takes all of your background and makes it relevant, brings it to bear. Because, you know, some jobs, all the experience and background I have in other areas, nobody cares. Just, can you do this thing? As a therapist, though, any experience that I have in any direction expands my client base. It opens up the number of people I can understand where they're at, what's going on, and I can help relate with them about what's going on. So having a wide, eclectic background is a tremendous asset as a therapist, whereas it isn't necessarily in a lot of other endeavors.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just useful at cocktail parties. And
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's just like, I mean, some people don't understand curiosity, which is one thing I've noticed and kind of found interesting, where it's kind of like, but another thing I've learned from doing this show, from interviewing all these people, is that just because you don't understand it doesn't mean it can't work. And it's just because, like, I remember the incident, not the incident, incident where I was talking with Fred Cyber once again, and we were talking about Hanna-Barbera, and I said, like, oh yeah, Scooby-Doo was kind of dead in the 90s when you were there. And he was like, yeah, I killed him. It's like, why? He goes, just like, and I'm talking as an actual Scooby-Doo fan, and he goes, just like, oh, I just didn't understand Scooby-Doo. I kind of thought it was like the end of cartoons. And so I just decided, like, yeah, we're not doing Scooby-Doo. So for like 5-6 years, Scooby-Doo just didn't exist because he didn't, A, like it, or B, understand it, really. As he said, he thought it was the death of cartoons. And then next thing you know, in 1998, they come out with Zombie Island, which is a huge hit. They have two live-action movies, and now they have, like, new movie and show every single year. It's been this money thing for decades now, ever since then, again. And he goes, just like, yeah, they did a great job with it. And it's just like, now it's taken off. And it's kind of funny to just think about him not liking it, held it back for a little bit, even though it was kind of plateauing for a while. And then once it's finally let go, just exploded. It was kind of interesting to kind of think about it. That's, I don't know, this interview is kind of starting to feel like a therapy session.
Well, that's okay. How do you feel about that, then?
So, Justin, tell me about your problem.
So it's really, but I mean, what's really true also is that one of the real truisms in the creative world is that ideas don't mean anything. Ideas are a dime a dozen. It's execution that counts. Like, how many ideas people go, oh, that we don't need that. That's garbage. That's baloney. You know what they used to say is that space action adventures are dead. Nobody likes space movies. That's done. Nobody wants to see that garbage. And so what happened was every major studio in Hollywood turned down Star Wars for exactly that reason, that, you know, oh, sci-fi's dead, space action, nobody likes that. And they all turned it down. The only reason Fox picked it up ultimately was because they had they had a contractual obligation to deliver 3 films in 1 quarter, and they only had 2. So they ended up picking up the Star Wars film just to fulfill a contractual obligation. They didn't think it was going to go anywhere or do anything, but they were stuck. And it had been literally rejected by every other studio in town. And, you know, it goes back to William Goldman, you know, a very famous screenwriter from a long time ago, wrote a great book called Adventures in Screenwriting. And in it, he talks about the first rule of Hollywood. And it's Goldman's first law of Hollywood, which is nobody knows anything, right? When it comes to predicting what people absolutely want and what they'll do, nobody really knows. You can only experiment. You can try to learn, because the same ideas that suck time and time and time again, someone comes up with a fresh take on it. It's the same thing, but this one works. Why does this one work and the other ones don't? Nobody knows. but you know it in the box office, and that's it. So that's another thing I explore in Once Upon Atari is creative process and creative environment. What does it mean to be creative? You know, how do you optimize a creative environment? How do you optimize yourself to be creative? These are all things that I explore in the book.
Yeah, and I mean, kind of to bring it full circle, do you think that was kind of the difference between like Atari and then like the Raiders of the Lost Ark game and like Yara's Revenge, or do you think it was kind of like something different there?
Well, E.T. was very different in the sense that you know, a lot of people criticize E.T., but the biggest problem that E.T. had was time. Because, like, Yar's Revenge was done in about 7 months. Raiders of the Lost Ark was done in 10 months. But when it came time to do E.T., there was only 5 weeks available. So this was a game that was done in 5 weeks at a time where it took at least 6 months to do a game. So the challenge for E.T. was just to deliver anything in that time frame. And I still developed, I mean, Yar's Revenge is known for setting a lot of industry standards and breaking a lot of new ground and stuff, because that's something I like to do. I want to make a contribution. I don't just want to make the next thing. And E.T., even though, you know, people knock it a lot and stuff, the truth is E.T. was the first game that came out with a three-dimensional world that you play on. It was the first game that had location-dependent power, you know, so that your powers, your special powers, whatever they are, change depending on where you are in the game. It was also one of the first entirely non-violent games. You know, E.T. is a totally non-violent game, which at the time was unheard of. And that leads to one of the great ironies. There's a whole bunch of ironic things about the whole E.T. development. But the biggest irony of E.T. probably is the idea that an entirely non-violent game is credited with having killed a multi-billion dollar industry. And I just think that's kind of delicious.
Yeah, because like you think about the rest of the more violent, the rest of the more controversial games in video game history. Although nowadays, pretty much you can just throw a whole entire EA Sports company in there. But besides them, the rest of the controversial games have all been violent. You think about like Call of Duty, Doom, which was also banned, which was also blamed for Columbine. The first ever congressional hearing on video games was held in 1993 about I'm blanking on the name, the one that like was the choose your story where they like wrap the thing around the girl's neck. I can't remember the name of it right now. But it was
Night Trap?
Yes, Night Trap. Yeah. Mortal Kombat. Like all these games besides EA Sports have had a violent twist to them. And it's kind of
interesting. Right. Grand Theft Auto got a lot of attraction also. A lot of attention, rather.
Yeah, but it's also like one of the highest selling video games of all time.
Yep, violence is a big thing. You know, you find it in entertainment a lot of places. There's the whole debate of whether, you know, games and violent movies and stuff cause violence. And that's a whole nother show.
Oh, yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts and research about that. But basically, people look for what they want for different reasons. You know, it's true that, you know, it's true that violent people typically have played violent games, watched violent movies, and they do violent things. They're violent people. And people think that because of that, there you go. Look, games cause violence. But that's lying with statistics. The great thing about statistics is that numbers don't lie. But the problem with statistics is that people do. Right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that you can't measure the tendency for games to create violence by looking at people who are violent and seeing if they played violent games, right? Because the truth is that all heroin addicts, you know, they started on milk, right? So what you have to do is you have to look at the percentage of people who play games that actually get violent. And when you look at the literally hundreds of millions or billions of people in the world now who play violent games, a very small percentage of those people actually do violent things. It's more likely that what happens is the cathartic effect of being able to excise some of your violent impulses in the game prevents you from needing to do it in real life.
Yeah.
But so that's a whole specious thing. But I got to tell you, it was emotionally violent world working in video games. That's the truth, because it was just so intense, and I loved it. It was an amazing place to be. And I wrote the whole book, Once Upon Atari, How I Made History by Killing an Industry. And if you found this interview interesting, you'll really like the audiobook, because it's available on Amazon as an audiobook or as a paperback or as an ebook. And it's also, I've just come out with the Spanish version. Erase Una Vez Atari is also available on Amazon.
All right. Yeah. I mean, like, we're coming towards the end of the time because it's only about an hour show, but I would love to have you back on to do the other show about video games and violence and that research sometime. But
I'd love to do that. We could also get into parenting, which is one of the greatest problems that video games pose in the world today is parenting. How do parents deal with their kids around video games? And I have plenty of thoughts about that.
Yeah, we'll have to set it up then. So one question I have for you, and I'm kind of curious about this. is A, what's your favorite video game system? And B, what's your favorite video game?
Yeah, this is a good one. You're gonna like this. So, my favorite video game system is probably a tie between the PS5, which I am really digging lately,
Okay.
and the Wii, because the Wii was really one of the first systems that got you physically involved in playing a game. And I think there's real meaning and value to that. I think that's a huge innovation. In terms of what I think is this is not necessarily my favorite game to play, although I like it a lot, but what I think is probably the best video game, one of the most significant video games ever made, it's Grand Theft Auto 3. Okay. Now, the thing is, that game has reprehensible theming. There's no question. It's just disgusting, some of the stuff you can do in it, and it's horrible, horrible, degrading stuff to do. But design-wise, it is a brilliant and innovative game. When I think of innovation in games in a video game, what I think of is, it's easy. People don't think it's trivial, but I mean, it's not hard to make technical innovations. I can make the same game with better graphics, especially in the next generation machine. That is a known doable thing. And so you can always count on the tech getting better. But that doesn't change the game. That just makes the game look cooler. What really counts in game is design. And you can't reliably design better. It just takes real insight and some genius to be able to really make a design innovation, to do something new. There's a couple of things they did in Grand Theft Auto 3 that were revolutionary in video gaming. For one thing, it was the bridge between 2D and 3D gaming. GTA 3 was one of the first games that really gave you a sense of a 3D world, really a sense of it. And you'd run around in it, and there you go. And that was a very different gaming experience. Another thing they did was they designed it in a way so that you don't have to have an infinite number of levels. What you have is a bunch of missions. And each mission is a separate activity to do. So you run out in the world and do this mission. But because they played them all in the same space instead of having a different level for each mission, which was typical in a lot of cases, you could learn stuff in one mission that would teach you how to do and innovate things in another mission. And that was very innovative. And that was a very smart way to go because it wasn't graphically a very innovative game, but design-wise, it was hugely innovative. Another thing they did was most games have what I would call a key and lock approach, which means you could have, there's a lot of different keys in the world, but only one opens this door. So there are some games you play where you have a variety of weapons, but you can only use one to do this particular task. And that doesn't really make sense in a video game. Why is it that these weapons are so powerful everywhere else, but suddenly they're ineffectual here? The other thing they did in Grand Theft Auto 3 was they fixed it so that anything that works in the world works everywhere in the world. And so if your mission is to go kill someone, which isn't, you can debate the morality of that, but if your mission in the game is to go kill someone, you can shoot them, you can stab them, you can shoot them at close range, or you can shoot them with a sniper rifle. You can put them in the trunk of the car and deliver the car to the crushing machine that'll then get them that way. You can blow them up with a bomb. There's a lot of different ways you can go. And a lot of games, they make it so that you have to go find this special weapon to get through this task. And that's just annoying. And that I think is lazy game design. What they did was they made a world where everything works everywhere you go. And so you can do things and approach missions any way you want to. And what that does is create a thing called metagame. So one thing we discovered at Atari was that it's one thing to play the game, but the metagame is when you start looking for other things to do in the game. And you talk to your friends about it. And you say, hey, I found this thing and I got this far in the game and I was able to do this. GTA 3 was able to have competitions where what's the weirdest way you can achieve this mission? We can all achieve it, but how did you do it? What's the most, obscure or obtuse way of approaching it? And that really increases the impression in the game world that's taking place. And I think GTA 3 was just such a huge step forward in that regard. And so many people copied what was going on there. I think it becomes one of the most significant games in history. So I hope that answers your question.
That answers it and more. I mean, like, we're out of time now, but that answers it and more. So it was very happy for the answers. I mean, I definitely agree with you on the Wii. I haven't yet gotten a PS5. I have a PS2 still, though.
I like that system, too. That's where I play GTA 3 on a PS2.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
and Jak and Daxter is another game that I played on a PS2 that I just love. I just thought that was another really well-designed game, really well put together.
Yeah.
And maximized the graphic capacity of the system in a beautiful way.
Yeah. I mean, but we're going to have to end it here. So, I mean, I've really enjoyed this conversation. This has been Justin Kenyon here on WBCR 88.3 Saint with Howard Scott Warshaw. Howard, thank you for being with us.
Justin, thank you for having me. Don't forget, Once Upon Atari is available, and I'd love to come back and talk to you again.
Yeah, love to have you on again.